Hi, everyone. Welcome to Weird Era, a literary podcast where we ask the right questions. Today, we are speaking with Alexander Sammartino about his debut novel, Last Acts. Alex lives in Brooklyn. He received his MFA from Syracuse University, and Last Acts is his first novel. Following a near-death experience, an entrepreneurial father and son duo wreak havoc and fend off bankruptcy in this unflinching portrayal of the absurdities of American life. Even though his firearm store is failing, things are looking up for David Rizzo. His son, Nick, has just recovered after a near-fatal overdose, which means one thing: Rizzo can use Nick's resurrection to create the most compelling television commercial for a gun emporium that the world has ever seen. After all, this is America, Rizzo tells himself. Surely anything is possible. But the relationship between father and son is fragile, mired in mutual disappointment. And when the pair embarks on their scheme to avoid bankruptcy, a high-stakes crash of hijinks, hope, and disaster ensues. Featuring a cast of unforgettable characters, this razor-sharp social satire lays bare both the gun and opioid crisis. Fans of Don DeLillo and Stephen Markley will be thrilled by the smart, inventive debut. Hi, Alex. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Trudy.
So we'll just get right into it if you've had a taste of our other episodes. Among the many things wrong with the world today, and I have to say in America in particular, you can't acknowledge that, especially in this book, is that the story zones in, as mentioned in the copy, specifically on the opioid and gun crisis. And I'm wondering what motivated you to choose to focus on those two issues, because there's a whole other plate of stuff that could have been selected as well. And so I guess my first question is, why did you focus in on those two issues? And my second question is, to what extent do you think those two issues are in conversation with each other?
Yeah. I think there are two issues that really terrify me and feel as much as we're a country founded on violence and gun violence, feel very contemporary and different. And they feel both the opioid crisis and the kind of mass shooting frenzy, they feel increasingly urgent, and they feel to me like something that awareness isn't resulting in change. And that's kind of terrifying. And in terms of their relationship, I was really fascinated with their relationship in the sense that as a country, we've treated gun owners very differently than we've treated addicts. And I was really curious about that idea. Like, if, you know, it, to me, a lot of times it seems very logical to want to, you know, kind of be sedated and to be completely removed consciously from the world to kind of experience that kind of, the kind of liberation that a certain type of drug experience can offer that's very appealing, because things often feel so terrifying and so crazy and so chaotic. Mm-hmm. And then alternatively, you know, being a gun owner is being seen as a patriot, being seen as someone who represents your country. But what if the opposite was true? What if someone like a gun owner was treated like an addict as and viewed as someone who needed help and who needed some type of support system around them? And so I was interested in the way that we as a country like view these two groups of people very differently and treat them differently. And I thought there was something kind of absurd in that, how easy it is to get a gun, how hard it is to get certain kinds of drugs. Like, there seemed to be really something rich there that I wanted to explore.
Just listening to you, it's so interesting, and it's a very reductive question, but I guess it's an angle I never necessarily took. You know, I'm also really scared about rising gun problems. I don't know. It sort of made me think, is nationalism a kind of addiction? Patriotism, rather?
I think it can be. I don't think I have the answer there for sure, but I can see it as being addictive and mm-hmm. being this kind of form of self-fulfillment, and kind of the more you practice it, the more pleasure you experience, and you kind of can't get away from it. So yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. I hadn't thought about that.
The title very much ties into the theme of the book's last acts. The book asks how we define ourselves and how what we can do at, you know, the quote unquote end of our life is often referred to in that definition. On page 11, Rizzo muses, he believed a man was the sum of his actions and he was dismayed by his own total. It made me think about immortality and this idea that even when our physical selves are gone, like our being still lives on. That's like the most obvious case for immortality, again, quote unquote. And it made me wonder if there's such a thing as a last act if you live on in memory.
Yeah, I love that. And I think, I don't know if I can answer that directly because it feels, I don't think I have the intellectual capability to do so. But I think one thing that interests me about the question is like, the way how we go about our lives defines who we are just as much as what we're doing in our lives. And I think that really interests me just from the perspective of fiction, right? Style and content to me are inseparable, and I'm very interested in the how. And I think when describing characters, that section you cited about Rizzo, it's a section about how he uses his gestures to communicate, how he goes beyond simple verbal communication, how important that is to who he is. And I think when I try to imagine a person and get to that essence, that thing that lives on, it's not just a story about them, but like how they conducted themselves, the way they ate, the way they told the story. And those are the things I really wanted to try to capture with Rizzo. And it's partly just because that's what I enjoy so much about people. It's also because I feel like that's what really good art does, is it goes toward that how and how someone's living and how someone is being. Mm-hmm. And then I think this is somewhat in your question, but there's a sense in which like, those small kind of details, those small gestures, those small movements, like that's what lives on of people. It's a beautiful way to put it, as you did.
Right. Like it's not literally the last thing you did before you died, or maybe even the way your life was before you died. It's a composite of other things, but there is, I do agree with that sentiment, but I also think that the book and the title and its themes are so poignant because I think socially and culturally, at least very much in the West, we may have this knowledge, but we still do live to a certain extent based on this idea of our last act, our, you know, what will people think of us before we go? And then that ends up being tied to morality. Will people think of us as good before we go? I guess there's no real question there, but really, I'm saying thank you to this book for sparking that conversation because I think it's so important. I guess given that this book explores the concept of endings in so many ways, as we pointed out, I'm wondering how much of a challenge it was to figure out how to end the book itself. Like, how many last acts did you go through before it felt like the final one, and what made you decide, okay, this is it? And without spoilers, ideally, for listeners.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I love that question. And yeah, I think just returning to what you said there, like especially Nick in the book is really trying to figure out, you know, given what his father is, who his father is, he has to decide how to kind of live in his wake and who he wants to be and what he'll leave behind himself. And I think that's a very kind of natural parent-child question. And it goes back to that sense of mortality that you brought up earlier. The ending itself for the book was always the ending. I always knew that's where it was going to end. And I always knew that that was the last word. And there's a kind of nice symmetry in the end with the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was more about how can I make that sense of ending repeat throughout the book without being redundant, and to make that kind of sense of apocalypse continue without feeling anticlimactic. And I think what the characters are struggling through is living, being in a family at a time when it feels like the world is always ending, and how you kind of negotiate that, how you love each other through that. That's how I feel. I think that's how a lot of people feel, you know, living in a state of just like constant crisis and bombardment with information. So I think that's just like one of the things that I can do in a novel that I can't necessarily do in real life, is try to kind of play with the structure, play with the content, play with the interaction, so that there's some sense of variance, and that creates a kind of dramatic energy that day to day I might not feel in real life, where I'm just kind of, you know, it's just a kind of onslaught of that sense of ending. So I think that was the challenge, was not so much the ending, but like what was going to lead up to that. That's where a lot of the revision, where I worked, where I did a lot of moving things around. Again, I knew I wanted to be a father-son story, and that idea of like the kind of two sections, one primarily from the father's perspective, one from the son's, had that nice symmetry. But I didn't want it to be too predictable. I didn't want the pattern to be too obvious, and I needed it to move and feel like it was still going somewhere, even though it's kind of just the sustained ending the entire time.
The book is more focused in so many ways than what it is to be alive, also considering about the end of our lives. Even though, you know, it's characters are under this constant threat of death. Do you think this book, and again, without any spoilers, ideally, insists on life?
100%. 100%. I think that, I forgot who I was talking to about this, but it's like, in works, novels that engage with, and short stories and poems, whatever sort of art, that engage with kind of a bleaker worldview, I think the really great ones are still not necessarily providing a solution or providing a path toward hope, but are in some way hopeful or life-affirming, you know, that's like a very popular phrase that appears on book copy, but I think that there's a lot of truth in that. Like, I think to me, that's where the energy from the language comes, is both kind of like outrage, but also love. And I think the characters in the book, and this is true very early on, you get this, right? Like Rizzo, he says this to his son. He says, you know, I'm angry because I love you. And that's like how his love manifests. And I think, you know, to be that angry, to have that sort of kind of like angled emotionality requires care. And I think that the only thing, not the only thing, but I think what isn't kind of insistent on life, going back to your question, is a like apathy and a disconnect. And so like I'm really interested in the opposite, which is kind of this really strong engagement with reality that might not produce exuberance, but that produces something that still is in its very nature insistent on life, because again, the anger comes out of a place of love.
That's so idealistic. I love it, but it's terribly idealistic, right?
Yep.
I think we're missing that in our culture these days. I think it's so hard to be idealistic as well, given everything that, you know, we can see happening and unfolding. But
I think art is very, just the nature of practicing this, and sorry to cut you off, but just like us having this conversation just feels increasingly, it's idealistic, it's romantic, right? Like there's no, this isn't something that's, going back to the end times thing, like it feels like, from an art perspective and from a literature perspective, I think people have felt this way for a while, but it's just like, you know, the state of things is not necessarily wonderful. It's not necessarily a wonderful time to be an artist. And I think like to do this, to keep doing this and to keep insisting on this and to have these conversations, like that in itself is very romantic and very idealistic. And I think that's why I'm ultimately in this business. It's because I can't shake that part of myself, no matter how much like everything else keeps telling me to like move on. It's just like, there's still that, you know, it's like a childish thing or just a naive thing, but it's like something very true to me where it's like, not that I think that like what I do is so noble, but I just think it's very romantic. And I think that it's very, it comes out of a place of like deep, deep love for the world. And I think that's true of everybody that's doing this. I don't want to speak for you, but I think like you're having these wonderful conversations with all of these writers. And I think that has to come out of a place of deep, deep care.
I think so. And thank you for saying that. And I definitely agree, but having interviewed multiple authors, I don't know if everyone else would I don't know if everyone shares in that sentiment in terms of the different authors that I meet and speak to. So it's it's deeply meaningful to hear you say that. I just don't know if everyone feels that way. So it's nice. It's nice to hear some people do.
Yeah.
My next question is sort of the same question in three parts. So I'll just read them out to you in sequence. What does the American dream mean to you? What does the American dream mean to Rizzo? And what does the American dream mean to Nick?
I think to me, the American dream is freedom. And I think with that comes in the most practical sense of economic freedom, right? And that's the most inaccessible, perhaps, depending on, you know, what perspective you're coming from. And I think that's what it means for Rizzo. I think for Nick, it's a bit more complicated. As someone who's in recovery, he wants to be free of a lot of things. And I think that's the sense of disappointment he feels he brought on his father, but also to be free of his own failures. And I think, again, going back to this kind of American dream, there's this kind of immortality to that freedom. Nothing can stick to you. Nothing can bring you down. And I think that's obviously unrealistic. And to have that ambition and to insist on that ambition is to definitely sign yourself up for some heartbreak. So I think that there's a lot of, freedom from economic precarity. I think that's my view. That's also in Rizzo and Nick. And then I think it's a little more for Nick specific to the relationship with his father and to his kind of searching for sobriety and meaning in life without drugs.
I've been accused of projecting the personal to my guests a lot, but it's not to say that you're anything of these characters. I do read more critically than that. But for instance, I read a lot of love and passion for the desert in this book, and I sort of wondered if that was something that was personal to you, if you could talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, I lived in the desert for a really long time. It's a really fascinating place to me, and I had a friend ask me, you know, if it felt stranger when I left, because I went to college in upstate New York and now I've lived in New York City for a while. And, you know, it's this kind of, it feels directly opposed in a lot of ways to New York. And I think it's like, it is and it isn't, right? So you have these kind of great geographic monuments that are just surrounding everything that you do. And then you also have this kind of consumer heaven that's happening. And then you have this kind of tremendous sense of patriotism and like the American mythology. That's really where it exists, I think, is in still the Southwest. And Phoenix specifically is such like a fast growing city that has changed so much in my lifetime and has been and continues to be at the kind of front lines of so many questions of what it means to be an American. So it still remains like a really romantic place for me. It's changing so much. It feels like it is such a, not a perfect stand-in, but like it's really easy to look at that and to think about the country as a whole. And so dramatically for a novel, that felt really useful to me. But yeah, there's a lot of the personal in that. The place means a lot to me. My parents live there. So I find it just incredibly beautiful.
I don't know if you would agree. I feel like there's a sort of canon of like desert novels. I'm thinking of, I don't know, John Fante or, you know, more contemporary writers that I've had the opportunity to speak to. Like it's a kind of a genre in and of itself. And I guess I'm wondering if you feel like this book, you know, fits into that genre.
So it's tough because I think that the desert novel, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think there's like the California desert novel. Mm-hmm. There's like the Las Vegas desert novel. Then, and that's like from a literary perspective. Then you have the Western as a genre, which is its own thing entirely.
Right.
And then you have like a couple books that are set that I can think of from a literary perspective that are set kind of in the greater Phoenix, Tucson area.
Right.
And the California desert books, I don't know enough about California to comment. Same thing with Vegas. But I think that like, to me, those are more kind of standard and obvious cultural monuments that we can refer to and be like, oh yeah, I know that sort of spectacle. Whereas like, for me, Arizona remains a bit more like wilder in my mind, and the representations are fewer. And I think of like two books in particular, and I talk about these books a lot because I really love them, but one is Angels by Dennis Johnson. It was his first novel. Mm-hmm. First half is a road trip novel, and that second half really takes place in the kind of greater Phoenix area. And that's where Dennis Johnson lived. And it's just some really beautiful desert writing and writing about family and tragedy as well. And then the other novel is Underworld, and that's by Don DeLillo. And it doesn't really, I feel like the first time I read it, I never really thought about it as a desert book because it's where the character really goes to retire and where he brings his mom at the end of her life. And so much of it is about New York and LA and other places as well. But I think kind of revisiting it, it really does feel like a great kind of Arizona book. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is like, I think there is a kind of a desert canon, but I don't know if there's as much of that literature that's focused specifically on Arizona as there is on like the Southern California and the kind of surrounding Vegas desert. And I think that there's some like further specificity there that's rich and can be explored still. And then I'm hoping to do in this book and other stuff.
Oh, I think absolutely. I have sort of a very romanticized view of all of those desert genres you've outlined. Being a Canadian and coming from a winter city, it's
right.
It's a very romanticized version. There is definitely an obvious sort of aesthetic beauty to it that I love to read. On page 20, you write, "Yes, it was true that the gun took its form from no object in nature, but the response to the appearance of a gun could not be more instinctive, terror mixed with awe." And I love what this sentence says about man-made threats to man. And I'm sort of wondering if you think there's something about, again, a wide question. You know, having spoken to you, I feel like you're going to tell me that you're not the one to answer this, but you wrote this sentence, right? And so I'm sort of thinking, are you thinking about this self-destructing habit inherent to being alive?
Yeah, totally. And I think to be an American, right? And that's okay. Like going back to And that's probably a little, there's some hubris in saying that. I don't want to say that other right. people aren't above destroying themselves, but I think guns and opioids are great examples of that, right? And so I think one of the things that fascinates me about guns, and one of the book keeps returning to this idea, is that guns are a form of technology, and technology exists to solve problems. And the problem that a gun is trying to solve is killing, making killing easier. And so, mm-hmm. You know, when you optimize killing to such a degree, when you mass produce killing, and then that functionality is turned on yourself, your own species, that's quite terrifying. And there's no kind of reference point naturally to point to say like, oh, that's like, such and such a plant or such, you know, there's we made this, we did this thing. And I think that's something the characters are struggling with, like going back to that question of freedom, like these are ultimately men of privilege, and they are in a lot of ways like bringing on their own kind of doom and their own suffering. And I think that relationship between freedom and disaster, and kind of like how we use our freedom, and the gun is like a tremendous symbol of this, is really tragic. And there's an opportunity for something that's really rich and kind of terrifying. And that's mm-hmm. that's like, 100% what I wanted to explore in the book, is like what it meant for these specific characters.
Yeah, I mean, it's also true, right? It's like true in a very obvious sense about the gun. I think this is such an insanely great sentence. And it's very specific to the form of the gun, but, you know, it speaks also to the self-destructing habit of drugs, and how, you know, people are drawn to these things that tear themselves up or are violent to their own well-being. I don't know. That's one of the saddest things about humans, and I never really understood it. I still don't really understand it. Like, I understand not loving yourself 1,000%. I understand, like, the hangups of having an ego, but I never understood, and this goes back more specifically to guns, the willingness to me, it feels like walking around with a bomb on you all the time. And just sounds really anxious, but clearly to so many gun owners, especially in America, this is not a shared sentiment. Maybe that's my Canadian bias. I don't know.
No, I think a lot of people are terrified, and that's why they own guns. It's like that. It's a way to kind of like
right.
assuage personal terror and anxiety. And I think part of what you said that I was really thinking about as well with the book is like how hard it is to love someone who is going through that kind of like self-destruction, right? So like you can't change that. It doesn't matter what you think. You're just kind of like bearing witness to it. And I think that's what the reader is doing a lot in the book with Nick and with his father mm-hmm. in different ways, like just watching him self-destruct and, you know, feeling love for them and knowing that things can't be different than they are.
Mm-hmm. I sometimes wondered if there was an intentionally gendered aspect of this book, because the mother character is obviously just not as central. It's very much about a father and son relationship. And so, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Is that something you were thinking about intentionally? If so, why? What brought you there?
No, it totally was. And it's a question, I don't know that I was always really aware of this when I started writing, and just like, I probably am still not aware of it a lot in my own life, but the way that my own identity bears on the way I view the world. And I remember being in a workshop and turning a story in and someone writing like, oh, this is so great. You're writing about these, you know, these men in this way. And I'm like, man, like what? This is about this other stuff. And I'm like, wait a minute. No, like this is what this is about. And I kept thinking like, yeah, like not that this is always what I want to write about, but with this book in particular, I was really interested in the way these men form their identities and form their relationships to the world and try to love each other. And I think there's an obvious similarity between myself and the characters, but I think to me, it's just also kind of like one of the few things I have some like potentially worthwhile perspectives on is like, yeah, I'm a man like these guys are in the world. And like, I am interested in these types of insecurities and ambitions and attempts to realize yourself in this kind of like ridiculous way. And so the maleness, again, the gun itself is a very gendered object. And yeah. I think, you know, it was something I really like tried to embrace in my own work. And instead of trying to like figure out ways around it, it was like, let me go toward this. Let me confront this sense of like maleness that I think has been, you know, very much a part of my life. And then that I want to explore in my work as well.
Can you describe to listeners what Uncle Gio means in this book as a feeling of agita or agita? I went with agita.
Agita.
Agita, great.
Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. No, it's a great, it's one of my favorite parts of the book. And just to go back to what you said, yeah, I totally agree again, without wanting to self-aggrandize. I just, you know, like there's this great, I feel like I'm walking on landmines here, but I just, I think that, you know, looking at all types of identity and interrogating identity is like a really valuable thing. And I think to your point, like rather than trying to have a certain like machismo toward this kind of male bravado, but instead exploring a kind of vulnerability, not in a sort of men's right sort of way, but just in like, hey, like how to like, I want to love this person. How do I love this person? How is this person being in the world? Like that to me is what is really interesting, is just kind of looking at a group of people honestly. And I think there's that type of maleness that's what I'm trying to do. And that's what I'm interested in. So anyway, I'll move on from that. Uncle Gio, I think Uncle Gio is kind of the family philosopher, and he claims to be ripped off by Jean-Paul Sartre, who he also claims to have been friendly with and to have slept with Simone de Beauvoir. And he claims that a lot of like the existential dread that really comes out of Kierkegaard came out of him, Uncle Gio, and he came up with this term agita, which is a very common Italian-American expression used a lot in my family. And it refers to this kind of agitation, specifically kind of like heartburn that you'll get. And there are two very common causes of agita, you know, a meal, a really heavy acidic meal, and then your family driving you nuts. And so you feel that in your chest, you feel the agita. And Uncle Gio feels that this is a defining experience of reality, and that he was again ripped off by these kind of like privileged French philosophers who went on to become so famous, and he's been overlooked his entire life, and he's just a struggling photographer. And I think he really represents in the book, he introduces Rizzo to guns, and he's someone who embraces this kind of like technology first mindset of like, hey, these objects define us, we should embrace them and figure out ways to use them meaningfully. And one of his obsessions is with guns, and he passes that on to Rizzo. So yeah, he's the kind of like crazy uncle at the dinner table who's ranting, but that like you always kind of want to listen to, but then you're always wincing about like what he's going to say next.
I loved the introduction of that word in this book. Let's talk about the role of commercialism in this book. There's an obvious critique of capitalism, especially at a pivotal scene around the filming of a commercial, as alluded to in the book copy. And I guess I'll spoil this much The commercial is almost accidentally successful because of a grand display of genuine vulnerability. I mean, going back to our aforementioned conversation on masculinity. But even in that success, it functions as a commercial. It's a success, but commercially so. Selling out for selling more in many ways. Can you talk to me about this relationship between commercialism and authenticity? And I just want to make one more note, because something that readers who may not have gotten to your book yet will get to experience is you sort of scatter the book with a lot of SEO, with a lot of like literal ad copy, ad language. But the book is so heavy on emotion and feeling, and it's a very interesting juxtaposition. And so with that being said as well, can you talk to me about this relationship between commercialism and authenticity? And how it came to be in this story particularly.
Yeah, I think it's really central to the book. And a couple things that were on my mind. One was just the way that like a certain type of capitalistic system can deploy cultural values to its own benefit. So the way that inclusivity is monetized, the way that suffering is monetized. And in this book, for people who haven't read it, the father-son team, what makes them ultimately successful is that they say that they're going to donate portions of their gun sales to kind of rehab and treatment centers for, and just kind of resources for addicts, deliberately ambiguous. And what I was interested in, again, is the kind of idea where as consumers, we and our kind of our desire to do good is taken advantage of for a purchase, and the absurdity of that in a lot of things. And so my wife and I, we always watch Shark Tank like half ironically. And, you know, there's always like this entrepreneur who's like, I want to do good for the world. And to do good, I'm going to give you like a really strangely shaped plastic object and I'm going to plant a tree in return. Right. And it's like, well, what are we doing here? Like but there's something really persuasive as a consumer to know like, oh, I might be doing something good. That's great. Like, let me give my money to this.
Right.
So I was really interested in exploring that. And again, kind of the way that this system can appeal to kind of our own morals and monetize those things. But I think, what also interested me about these two men in this setting, again, being in kind of the American Southwest, is it's the desert. They're trying to kind of like build their own reality. And the way that they do that is by kind of achieving the certain like economic success. And there's absurdity in kind of what success looks like within the system. I had a guy I worked with once who I was talking to him about being in an MFA program, and he was like, oh yeah, my sister just got her MFA from Harvard in acting. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. Like, how's she doing? And he's like, really, really great. Like, she just was in a Snickers commercial. And I was like, man, you know, he's right. She is great, but that's also absurd that greatness is in being in a Snickers commercial.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And I talk about, you know, we see this all the time with like, especially in our generation, like seeing celebrities age and being forced to do or choosing to do more and more ridiculous advertisements for more and more ridiculous products. And it's like, you know, the way that you have to kind of like humiliate yourself to benefit financially. I think Nick kind of has a breakdown in that ad filming that you were referring to, because he's like, there's a line where he's like, this is stupid and I can't even do it right. And, you know, that's, I think, like, just wherever, whatever industry you're in, there's an element of that that people experience with their own work. And again, with like, it's on both sides, right? It's on the side of production, like within your work, you feel dehumanized and you want to do good. And it feels like even when you're successful, you're still failing and doing something absurd. And then it's on the consumer side where it's like, hey, I'm going to buy something to do good because I don't know how else to do good. And actually, I don't even know if this is doing good either, but like, hey, at least someone told me that. And so I was really interested in the way that like contemporary capitalism is able to exploit those things from every angle. And I wanted to show the effects. And again, just kind of going back to using Phoenix as this like stand-in for America, but like this father, son, this family, this very specific family, as a, these kind of the generational consequences for them, right, in living in the system.
Given our earlier idealistic conversation about sort of writing, and that being an industry in and of itself, I'm sort of wondering how you might reconcile those two things. You know, having this really wonderful and again idealistic view of the work, but still being an author out here who obviously would like to sell his books. How do you sort of, maybe you don't need to reconcile that, but do you, and what are your thoughts of that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's such an important question. I think you kind of have to reconcile it. I think I feel really lucky because I'm at a publisher that is like extremely loving and encouraging of me. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, hey, you have to go out and hit this number. I was told very early on at one point by someone at the company, like, hey, you're not going to sell any books and that's okay. And so I was like, wow, that's awesome. Like that's,
yeah.
And it's like, that's one of the benefits of being at a publishing house that, has a lot of wildly successful people that can make up for the people like me who are dragging us all down on mm-hmm. the spreadsheets, you know? But, so yeah, I think like, I definitely, want to sell books. I need to, you know, I need to live, obviously.
Mm-hmm. We all do.
Yeah, we all do. And I think, it's a question I asked myself because the past 5 years, I just recently left my job, but I was working in software sales and I was like justifying what I was doing because I was like, I'm an artist. Like I'm just trying to make some money until I can publish a book and then I'll get out of this. Mm-hmm. And, ultimately I don't know how to reconcile that. The way I've tried to do it is just by ultimately putting like everything I have into the work and just about that. And, you know, I know a lot of people feel like compromised by their use of social media and like various promotional things that they'll have to do for their work. And again, to me, it's just like, you know, hopefully no one's going to remember that shit in 50 years. And instead what they're going to remember is like the book. And so I think like, just putting
last
all of that
act.
Last act. Yeah, that's it. And so I think just putting all of that energy into work, like that's, I don't think I have an answer, but if I have an answer, like that's the only thing, at least I delude myself into thinking is like, as long as I care about the art and everything I'm doing is for the art and I have a publisher who supports me and I'm very lucky in that. And obviously that's a very rare thing, but having that level of support, like that, I don't know, ultimately makes me feel like I've achieved some sort of reconciliation, even if I haven't.
On page 150, a character muses, maybe it's the families who agree to go on intervention who have a disease. Can we flesh out the sentence a bit?
Yeah, I love, so within the context, it's like overheard at a party. And there's a group of people who are like at different, you know, points or different philosophies about recovery. And I think that this is true to my own experience is that like everybody kind of recovers in their own way. And I think it's, there's often this kind of like single-minded narrative about sobriety that I don't necessarily adopt or think other people should. But in that particular quote, the person is suggesting, like on a literal level, obviously, you know, like if your whole family is willing to deceive you and expose you publicly to the nation that you're an addict and you need help, like maybe they're the ones who are fucked up. And I do think that there's some truth in that. And I was really fascinated with intervention. And like, there's a part of the entire book that came out of intervention where, going back to the idea of like a suffering economy, right? Or an economy of suffering, like the ability to monetize and to publicize someone's struggles for your own benefit, not to the family's benefit, but to the network's benefit, to the advertiser's benefit, right? Like that to me feels really kind of gross and unfair and exploitative. And so I think that's what I was trying to get at. And that's an idea again, that like really kind of was with me from the beginning of the book that I wanted to consider. And that was kind of how I ended up sneaking it in there.
On page 176, you write, "Family is a threat to the market, hence why the market targets the family." How is family a threat to the market? And in what ways does the market target the family?
Yeah. I think, oh man, the target question is like in so many ways. And there's this, I think the kind of great example of this in literature is Don DeLillo's White Noise, where the family is sitting around the table, right? And all of the kids are reciting this different ad copy that they've heard on the radio. Mm-hmm. And the idea that DeLillo kind of states explicitly in that novel is that it's really the kids who are the ultimate victims of this sort of like, you know, fascistic advertising. And that also makes me think of this Godard quote from Made in the USA. Very straightforwardly, advertising is a form of fascism. And I think the family unit is a place where values are learned. And again, being really idealistic and romantic, it's also a place where like you have the kind of truest connection with another person and the truest love with another person. And for the market, there's like a element of vulnerability there, and there's a way to kind of like, once you get in with the family, right? Like once you get in with the children or once you get in with the parents, you have their data, you could sell them everything forever. You're with them for a really long time. I think that I'm trying to think about like how the family can stop the market, but I think, and not being romantic and ambiguous about it, but I don't really know. To me, it's
or
just
even threatens, as you write, just maybe doesn't, you know, beat it, but threatens it. I thought that was an interesting concept.
Yeah, I guess just like, I hate saying this because it sounds, again, like really romantic, but this is just kind of like who I am and I have to die on the sword a little bit, but it's just this kind of love between, you know, with the family, and that like there's this kind of like truth that exists in a family that's only known by the members of that family. And that, like, again, that is somehow very dangerous. The idea that like, you know, truth can come from your parents, from your siblings, from your grandparents, and not from a talking gecko on TV, right? Like that's I guess the way that the threat exists. But it just, again, it goes back to kind of it's a love for family, and I think that that's what the book is in a lot of ways about. It's just that like, you know, this kind of like turning toward each other and turning inward, that there's an opportunity for salvation there.
Thank you, Alex. This is great. Listeners, you can go ahead and pick up a copy of Last Acts at your local indie booksellers in Montreal. That would be Pulp Books. Thanks, Alex. This is great.
Yeah, thank you so much, Ruti. This is really, really fun. We'll be right back.